in physics and chemistry, and so I was out of money. And I had a friend who was working up here. He counseled me that there were there might be jobs here, because some of the students would be going back, some of the people would be students going back to school in September, so I should get across. This was August, late August. So I had 68 cents left and food, and so I hitchhiked to Darrington, then up to Seattle, and to the beginning of the trail going across Miner's Ridge to Holden. It's 21 miles, as I recall. It seemed like more. But I got there about 4 o'clock at the start of the trail and started hiking, and got up halfway up the mountain before it was too dark to travel. Camped there that night, went on, and the next morning went over to the across the Seattle Pass first, past Mirror Lake, where the Kennecott was once planning to dig copper, and then to Cloudy Pass, which we can see from the site, and then down to Lyman Lake, where I stayed that second night. And it was a very nice time, good weather, and so I came down here the next day and met my friend, met him about getting close to the dinner time, and he helped me, showed me how to get in, and we lined up with the other miners, and I just walked right through past Mr. Tinney, and he wasn't paying any attention to individuals like that, so I got a very good meal. I was very glad. I was lucky there. Now then, the other part of the luck was that I needed a job, and they had advised me not to go through the Chelan hiring office. So I didn't, so I had a better chance up here. Then I got here just as they were wanting to finish the rec hall before the winter came. This hall was mostly finished, but there was a lot of wiring yet to do, and so I told them I knew something about electricity, and they put me on and worked for 6 weeks. It was understood that my job would be short term. Then I went to, just as I was getting ready to be laid off, then the NRA came in and made it costly to work people longer than 8 hours a day. They had been working the mill samplers 12 hours a day, and two of them were filling the job 14 days a week, fortnight. And so they were getting very tired on that kind of a schedule, and they needed a third sampler, so I was here, and bing, I was in. Now I'll get into more about the sampling as we go along. This is the picture of the whole site. Now let's see, I think I'm blocking your view, am I? Here, I don't know where I can move. I move over to this corridor. Do I have enough cord here to take the... All right, that will do just fine. Now, you can see the tent site in the campsite down in the lower portion, and the mill, as you know, in the obvious area, and the mountain before they got a hole in it. Now the hole was not external. They had the hole was out of the center of it. You saw the tailings pile coming up on the bus. It's worth getting up to the mill level, 1,500 foot level, where you can look down on those tailing piles and realize what an immense amount of rock had been removed from the mountain. It was truly a hollow mountain. And the mine started, that is, the 1,500 foot level is at the head of the mill, and the 1,500 feet was just a datum point. It didn't refer to the sea level. Then they went going upward, then they had a portal at 300 feet, several portals, and the top one is at 300 feet from that datum level. So that's where the ore body was. The ore body continued down underneath and down on a slant. They found a lot more ore below the level of 1,500 and had to hoist the ore. This is a close-up of the town site, showing the bunkhouse at number 4, I believe, and over on the lower right is Mr. Curzon's house, and then the staff houses going up the street. I climbed a tree to get this picture, took a little hatchet and chopped away a few limbs so I could get a clear sight. And fortunately, I chose a resinous tree. It was the only one there was, and when I came down, I had pitch all over me. But still, it made a good picture. I made two pictures, one angled here and one a little farther to the left, and patched them together to make a single shot. The bunkhouse, as you already know, and the rec hall is just on the lower right here. You didn't get that in the picture. Didn't have a high enough tree, I guess. This is one of the staff residences. Several staff people stayed here. Those with families had also some single family homes. And this is looking the other direction now. This is up on, I don't know exactly where I took this picture, but it was high up a bit. It wasn't at the mill site. Town site is the triangle on the upper right, and the first of the tailings ponds was already in place. Now, the mine had been running only about a year when I got here, so the tailings pile was not all that big. They ran for another, 16 years, and really had some tailings piles, a big problem. Then the Buckskin Mountain is the mountain as you are standing at the rec hall looking over across the valley. That's the Buckskin is the one just to your left. It's a spire from here, although it isn't a spire all the way. It's a ridge. We look at the end of that ridge. This is the looking off at Bonanza Peak. We'll have another picture of Bonanza Peak. But this was fairly early in the spring when this was made, not winter yet, but that was gone. But coming down, as you're looking at Buckskin, you will see what could be filled with snow, a groove, couloir, coming all the way down from the peak, right down almost to the creek. And sure enough, I was there at just the right time. It was about 30, 40 feet wide with snow. Snow was stable, just right. I had my ice axe, and so I glissaded almost all the way down to the creek. Yeah, it was a wonderful ride. Oh, incidentally, on that last one, there was a mention here. I was walking down here, and Getty was saying to someone else that there was a mirror up there, and at certain times of the year, they could see that strong mirror down here. And so I spoke up and said, well, I'm the one who put the mirror up there. There's Buckskin right there. And you can see after getting down a little bit that then there would be a long chute coming down connecting to the lower level. Another shot. This showing the mill. Now, the mill was built on a hillside, obviously, so that they could run by gravity the flow through the mill. And the assay office is right there in the center on the right side. There is a connecting passageway across from the assay office, about 20 feet long, which we'll figure into a story. I will tell you later. But the mill is quite a high one, and it's quite a journey to climb up there. Now, this is a picture. I don't know where I got it, but I had it available, made a photocopy of it, and the saying is that these were the early miners that Holden had, or the earlier developer, had hired to try to find the ore body. The original ore body indication was an orange patch of rock up high on the mountain, about the 300-foot level, what we call that. And this, then, was the evidence that there was mineralization. The orange color was that of iron oxide, indicating that there was iron sulfide probably inside. They'd been oxidized, so it was an ore body there. And the original surveyor found, brought back a few rocks of that and just turned them over to somebody. And it was indicated that, yes, it was copper. There was copper in the iron with the iron sulfide. So they, that languished for quite a while and went through several hands. Holden tried to promote it. He raised cash for exploration and proved out the fact there was ore here, but not how much. And then Howe Sound Company bought the final property and developed it, as you know, starting production in 1937. There's an excellent book prepared by Nigel Adams, who was at a college, what's the name of it, out near Auburn. He was teaching geology and environmental. It was one of his theses that he did on Holden. Now then, unfortunately, he had a lot of notes from he published on the early years, Holden, but he was going to have a second volume, which was the production years. And he became ill when he was down here up at Domkey Lake and Mirror Lake beyond. And then he had to be flown out, and somewhere along the line he lost his briefcase with all his notes. They haven't been found and weren't left at home, and there was no copy. So it's unfortunately there will not be any such second volume unless somebody settles down to working it up again. The suggestion has been made that I have these pictures made into a sort of a photo snapshot of 2 years of the early production and have that printed and for a modest type of production and made available here to people who have come to Holden. Now these miners are replaced by a different kind of miner. These miners are all experienced hard rock miners. They are working under arduous conditions, as you can imagine, and yet they were very effective in producing a great deal of ore from the mountain. Now just a word about the ore. The ore was 1.5% copper. Copper is in the form of chalcopyrite. Pyrite is iron sulfide. Chalcopyrite is copper iron sulfide. And we'll talk more about that in the flotation section that's coming. First shots are of the mining operation, actually getting in there, drilling and blasting. They had lots of heavy equipment. You can see some of it. This is diamond drilling, I believe. It's exploring for the ore body. They did lots of diamond drilling and saving the cores and analyzing the cores and finding out the limits of the body. Another shot of the diamond drilling. You can see how it's rough work. The timbers down there below there are just heavy enough all by themselves without accounting for the heavy drilling equipment. Now we're into the place where they're drilling to blast. There's several such shots of that. These are air hammers, and they really make a racket. You can see down in the front there a bar going across. It has a mushroom head on it with flutes. And that's the diamond drill point, not diamond, that's the hardened steel point. There's another one down at the extreme lower left, which then shows that same head. Here they're drilling to blast out a face. They'll have quite a number of holes in there, have it all timed. Each one will be loaded with blasting powder and electrically fired caps. The technique was that they would have time delay. These are timed discharges, not all at once. The efficient way to do it is to get a double line of holes through the center of the array that blasts first. Only a matter of a hundredth of a second difference. But it makes a lot of difference in the breakage of the rock, because then when that first portion goes, the other portions, in moving sideways on the blasting, then are able to move a lot more rock because they have an easier place to blast the rock. Here they're loading the holes. This is one of the dangerous phases, although I don't know of any accident that they had while loading. This is, they're running adrift here, which is a tunnel across. And after they blast, of course, then broken rock has to be lifted out. There is, this is called mucking, and they have a definite job title as mucker for lifting, loading the rock away into the cars. That's hard work, and so the people here at Howe Sound, as a policy, were excellent mine operators. They built this whole town site, which is a show place of town sites, and it's living quarters in the whole country. And then they had first-class operation all along, strong emphasis on safety, and they did a very fine job. Part of the program was to save that backbreaking work of mucking, and this is a mucking machine. It's self-propelled on the rails and move forward and scoop up, and then the bucket goes over the top of the machine and drops into the car behind. Now, just a word about the method of mining. This is called stoping. And the stope is simply the name for a large cavern. The method is that they go drill in on the 1,500-foot level, run a drift going in as one of the main haulage ways. And going upwardly from that are a series of funnels. This haulage way intersects the ore body underneath it, and then, at least through it. And these blastings going up, raised shaft, are made as funnels. I'll show one of those a little bit later. And the ore then is blasted and goes down through the funnel, down through a grating, called a grizzly, and then it drops into the waiting car below. So see, gravity is doing the work. Well, they made the primary cavity up there, and the next cavity that they build, the next blast is that they go in on a higher level over the top of the roof of the cavern that's already been created. This then gives them a very great efficiency of letting gravity do it. They go in, drill and load and blast, and that roof then caves down onto the funnels, which are kept in place as long as they can, and keep working progressively upwardly, always blowing the roof of the cavern down. There was one setting at a race where they had 32 tons of powder in their blasting. And they have a system of what they call the brass. The brass, it means a name tag and a number. And when they get ready to do the blasting, which was every second Sunday, they had a board. Every time anybody went in there, he had to put his brass up there on his pin. And then they did not blast until every one of the brass numbers had been accounted for. So that was a safety feature. They didn't lose anybody in blasting. Then the 32 tons really shook this valley. We all knew when it was going to be, 8 o'clock. And so, whoa, that tremor went through the whole place. Now, that last picture was looking into the stope. It gave you some idea of the size of the stope, but here's a different look at it. You can see over to the right there, against the white cloth, you can see the image of a man. That gives you the size of this. He was just standing there being a size scale for my photo. But you can see how big a hole it is. And this was just the beginning, really. And this is only 1 year in production. Now, I spoke about the hole in the bottom, the funnel. The material is coming down. Is, of course, when the blasting takes place, they don't know how big chunks of rock they're going to get. And only a certain size can be accommodated into the jaw crusher. So here they are barring down this piece of rock. If it won't go through the grizzly, then it's too big, and then they have to set a charge on it and blast on that one piece. That can be done without vacating the mine. It's just the big blasts require the vacating. Because the reason for the vacating is that Yes, the people aren't near the blast, but the shake will shake down all the loose rock along the drifts. Now, once in a while, the funnel gets stuck and gets clogged with blast, the stoping operation blasting down. And then the miners have to go up with a bomb and place that at a strategic spot, hoping to, well, they do, knocking loose the chalk stone, as it were, and then they're out of there, of course, look at the long fuse, and then after it's shot, well, then they go back and see if it's successful. If it's not, they give it another bomb. Now, it's hot, I mean, it's not hot, it's a cold mountain, a cold mine, but this is heavy machinery, and they really have to work to move it. It's a tough job. Another setup of drilling where they're using a jack against the roof, a roof jack, and then they're able to get stand from which to do the drilling. They don't drive it in by hand. The nippers are collecting the steel, the dull steel, and putting it on the carts and bringing it out to the shop where the drills will be sharpened. They're heat-treated, special hard steel. The mine was operated centrally around a hoisting shaft. This is the hoist operator right here. He's got the cables that are connected to the man cage and the ore cage. There are two of them, but mostly it's a man cage. This is the hoist operator, not the operator. Yeah, he's the hoistman, and he rings the bell in a certain sequence, asking the operator at the drums to take the cage to a certain level. Here's the ore coming out. This is I don't know how many cars in there, but probably about six or eight, bringing in lots of ore. And they said it was hot, dirty work. Well, here they are around the wash-up. They have both the wash-up and they have showers. And so I asked them all if they'd put their heads out so I could take their picture, and they did. So the clothing gets very wet and dirty, and they have to dry it out between shifts. And this is a warmly heated room where the lockers are, and each man has a cord on a pulley, and he puts his clothing on that and hoists it up, his mining clothing up there to dry for the next shift. He says he's using the water of the baskets for flour baskets now around. I didn't know that.
It still smell?
Now, being remote, they had a very well-equipped warehouse. They couldn't send out 2 days to wait for a part. And so they had a lot of spare parts, all planned ahead, what things might be needed as replacement. And they did a very good job that way. Now, there was a question in the beginning whether to generate power from Railroad Creek down at the falls. That is, there's a lot of fall between the level of the town site, putting a dam up here and then running a flume along the side where the road is, and then you come to the end of it, drop the water down to lake level and generate power that way. But they did an engineering calculation and they said that just wasn't capable of producing enough power. They put in that long, expensive power line, 110,000 volt power line that went up the east side of Lake Chelan and crossed over at the proper point, came up the valley to here. These transformers are 3,000 kilowatts each. It's a lot of power being used in here. A lot of it being used for the development of compressed air, because all the drills were operated with compressed air. The compressed air had two functions, of course. It powered the equipment, but it also purged the atmosphere in the mine. They had a well-equipped machine shop. They were able to make machinery here and do a lot of repairs of all the equipment. Being so remote, it pretty well had to be self-sufficient for many things.
Was this up on third level, that machine shop?
That previous shot is, these are all here on the 1500 level. The machine shops are just beyond the head of the mill, but on the same level.
Okay, right. Yeah, 1500
foot. Did I say anything else? 1500 is what I meant. Now, they built a drilling machine. This had 12 drilling heads on it when they got through. They designed that here and were making an advance in the state of the art. Holden served as an advance. They did lots of things here that were unique that were then copied elsewhere around the world. This is a picture of the sharpening shop where the drills were, tips were heated, and then forged and sharpened, and then heat treated again and quenched to make them as hard as that steel would go. The ore being dumped into the main ore bin. The ore bin is long gone, but for a while there, some years, the steel had been taken away from the bin, but the ore that was in it, when they shut down, they just left that ore bin full instead of working it all the way through the plant. They took away the steel and the ore was sufficiently mudded together so that it stuck together and stayed standing. I haven't been up there this trip to see whether it's collapsed. Still there? Yeah. Well, you can take all you want of that as long as you don't remove a chalk stone that brings the whole lot down on you. It won't have much grade in it. As I said, it started out at 1.5%, and then it went down to about 0.7%. That's about the time they started to, had to shut down. It was just too low a grade to support the mill, support the whole operation. Now then there is a feeder, a vibratory feeder, fed from the bottom of the ore bin outward. This man is watching out for steel. He's watching out for tramp iron and steel, especially drill bits that would go through and damage the rest of the equipment. At that time, the first processing step was jaw crusher. The jaw crusher was at the head of the mill just underneath the ore bin. They tell me that after I left sometime, they were getting ore from lower than the 1500 foot level, and so they moved a primary jaw crusher inside the mine and then brought it out and put in another cone crusher, a couple of cone crushers to get more capacity, because the idea was during the war at least to get more capacity of copper, afterward to get more capacity for just the copper, have the mine produce more. And then these jaw crushers, these were running around 300 horsepower, and the flywheels were going around good clip. When the rock hit there, large rock, you could hear the crunch, 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 crunch all over the valley. This is after the primary crusher, then there'd be another magnet there, a huge magnet, in order to pull out more tramp steel. Going under a weigh belt, that's the box on the right. That gave a totalizing weight as to how much is going through and also instantaneous reading for the control of the subsequent operations. The next operation was cone crushers. Cone crushers, as you see here, are about 5-6 feet in diameter. The two of them there in different size. The cones are the internal cone is rigged on a gyrating axis, and it goes around and around. The outer one is fixed, but as the inner one goes around, the upper space is around 1.25 inches, and at the bottom it's 1/4 inch, so that everything that goes down gets crunched by this gyrating action, as if you were mixing up something in a bowl, only it's crushing. The 1/4 inch mesh then was fed on to the ball mills, These are, again, these are 500 horsepower ball mills. The ball mills have special cast steel balls that have manganese content for wear resistance. They go in there starting the size of a softball and then gradually wear down until there's nothing left of them, but the charges, total charge weight, is kept up by additions of the steel balls. These make a continuous roaring noise, quite a noisy plant, especially here. The ball mills mill the material down to, this is wet milling now, they've added water, and by slurrying methods and settling, they're able to classify it and get the fines to go on through to the flotation cells, and then they course go into another circuit and they're pumped back to the head of the ball mill, recirculating, so they can get everything down to a certain feed. One of my assays as a sampler, mill sampler, was to check the degree of grinding. It has a limit, I forget, but it's something like 8% of plus 100 mesh. So the rest of it had to be minus 100 mesh and to go on through. That was the standard for grinding. And I'd gather a sample and run for the lab, dry it out, put it in the vibratory screen, and report the result back to the grinding operator. That was every 2 hours, along with a lot of coppers. Now, this is a picture of the flotation section. I have a better picture of the float cell, but you can see the long pathway. Right in the center of the picture, there's a man standing there. He's parallel. That whole runway is the flotation cell. It's a matter of 50 feet long, 6 feet wide, and has about 20 feet deep. This is kept in a turmoil by bubbling through pipes, which we'll see a little bit better. Now, to separate the chalcopyrite from the pyrite, they added pine oil to the mix going into these flotation cells. There were two of them. Then pine oil with special chemicals, xanthines, they were called, would wet the chalcopyrite, but by another method would not wet the iron pyrite. Iron pyrite was not valuable. So then the chalcopyrite would make a greenish froth on here and would bubble over the edge. The float operator would maintain an exact height on the operation so the froth would go over, but the water containing the rock, ground rock, plain rock, would not go over. This is Oscar Wicken. He was thinking to come here today. He was here last time, and yet he didn't make it. This is Victor Zanadvorov. He's the metallurgist. He came from Russia, been educated as a metallurgist over there, and he got out just ahead of the revolution over there. He had to travel. He told me all the way from, he was hoping to get out of Shanghai and lost that chance, and he had to, I don't know how he did it, but he got all the way over to the Mediterranean, got out that way. That's a long shag, rivaling Marco Polo. Only he did it a lot sooner. Now he's putting his hand in there and he's touching the froth, and you can see from the dull appearance of it that it's not just soap bubbles, it's laden with the chalcopyrite. After the float operation, that concentrate is still quite wet, and that is high percentage of water, and it's put into the thickener here. The thickener then lets the water settle, and that water is reused. It's put back to the head of the mine, up to the head of the float cells anyway. And then the surface concentrated oily stuff goes into the filters. Each one of these filters, 5 feet in diameter, is like a pancake. It's got filter cloth on both sides of the pancake. Of the eight in series there, they're all the same, each one. There's a vacuum pulled on the inside while the filter is dipped into the concentrate. And then as the wheel comes around, the top is the excess water pumped out of it. And on the far side, there are scrapers. The scrapers scrape off the semi-dried concentrate. That drops onto a belt and is carried onward to the loading dock. The loading dock then is for putting into the buckets, they're called. They're the size you see, the man standing alongside it. Is that you, Bob Young?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where, you are?
Big one.
Yeah, Bob, is that you?
Yes.
Yes, it is. Okay, he's over here. We can see him as an anthropological curiosity here when you get through. Anyway, he isn't working very hard. He looks well-dressed, and so... the concentrate content was 5 tons. And take him, as we'll see in a moment, down to the loading dock at the Lucerne. Who's that up there? Dick Patterson? Is this...
Dick,
yeah. Well, you see, this was a stage shot. Neither one of them worked there. And it was shut down at the moment. That is, there was shut down every 2 weeks, and so I wanted to get a picture. So he went up and got into the operator's cage. Then makes a good shot and good conversation. Now, the ore buckets are... the mill management... I cooperated with me here. They wanted to get a lot of these pictures too, and I was showing ambition and talent. They arranged for all four of the trucks to be lined up all at once. That would not be normal. They would be normally going down one at a time as soon as loaded. But made a good shot. Now, what do you do with the tailings? See, this is 1.5% copper. And so the tailings are waste rock, but they contain some chemicals. They contain some residual copper, not much, and contain a little zinc. After a while, they separated zinc, but at the time I was here, they were not. And there's a little bit of cyanide in there, not much. Lime, yes, that was used to get the pulp to settle, that is the powdered rock in water. To settle in the settling tanks. So they have the ponds, settling ponds. You can see around the rim there is a dike. And this is quite early in the time. They hadn't fully developed, but then another picture a little bit later, or the next one rather, will show how they have the pipe thing in the foreground. There is a black pipe going across. It had valves in it, and it could spill out the waterborne tailings. It dropped back down onto the pond, and by the time the tailings, the wet, had flowed to the center of the pond, where there was a drainage hole, then a lot of the fines would be settled out. Most of it would be, although still some milky fines would get through into the river and the creek. Now they didn't bother to log out the trees. They didn't last very long anyway in that kind of a base. Here are the people building the dike. They didn't move very much of the tailings. They just simply used it to patch the holes in the dike as they went on up. And so they brought in, as you can see on the right, there was a slope. The slope was intentional because it wouldn't slip. Unfortunately, the slope is a little too steep and it's vulnerable to washing and rain overflow. There wasn't any much of a problem when I was here because the whole pile was not that big. There was trouble later as they went on. Got too close to the creek for one. When a big flood came, I started to undercut the side of the pile. Now this was all under control, chemical control. This is a chem lab, assay office, and Lynn Bennett is on the left, and let's see, what's the guy's name in the center?
Jack Dewey.
No, Jack Dewey's on the right. The one in the center, oh, Bud Ostlund. We haven't heard anything from Bud Ostlund, although Lynn Bennett was here at some of the earlier reunions. I don't know where Dewey is. He went to another mine, I believe. And here's the office where they had lots of accounting to be done, payrolls to be prepared, purchasing. And of course, core of the operation was the engineering. They had to do all this planning from the diamond drill results, planning where to drill next, how far to move, what to do. They had lots of work to do in the engineering to keep ahead of the mining. Now, this is the doctor's office. They had a doctor on staff all the time. And what's that?
Dr. Wong.
Yep, I had forgot his name. Thanks for that. And the iodine swab that he has there is an artificial. It was not intended to be used, especially since this was an automatic. I had set the camera to go off automatically, and I was the subject getting that iodine swab.
Can I interrupt you a minute?
Go right ahead.
That sink in the corner, when I went to work there, they sent me down to see if I was healthy enough to go to work. And he said I'd like a urine sample. Well, I just went before I got in there, and I couldn't make it done. That boy just walked over to another sink and turned the water on. And I started, and I said, what am I going to do with the rest of it?
I didn't get all of that, but I don't know. Do we want him to repeat it? No, it was not all hard work. This is the mucker's ball. We had New Year's Eve. So we had a big dance and festivities and a Christmas tree over there in the corner. And the school. Unfortunately, I didn't get the teacher in the picture, and I should have. And who was the teacher at that time? This was 3840. Maybe one of you was in the picture. I don't know. Duran, are you here? Duran Curzon, daughter of... Do you remember any of the people here? You were in school at the time this was made then, this general time?
Right, I'm not there.
You're not there. Well, they all look very studious, attentive. The Howe Sound Company realized that the miners had to have some kind of recreation, so they put in the pool tables, and then in the very back, which they later closed off, was a poker table. And of course the fountain, you know, hasn't changed, only they served more variety there. I don't know what all they did, I forgot. And the poker game in the back room there, you can't see it from where you are, but the man in the lower left is holding a hand with five aces. It was staged. They threw in the hand without shooting him. And of course, the gymnasium where you are now. This is where the mucker's ball was held. You saw it full of people then.
Please notice the beautiful roof on that.
What's that?
Notice the beautiful roof. Ceiling. No psychedelics.
They were having fun at it. They liked the sport. In the bowling alley, you have seen. I didn't take any pictures with people in it, but it's still there. You have to load the pins by yourself, however. There was, at that time, there were paid pinball setters.
Those were wooden pins.
Yeah. Yeah, they were wooden. There, you got a strike out of that one, it looks like. And here we are in the same, well, across the street, I mean. Same dining hall, different settings a little bit. Snow. Snow was a way of life. They told me last night that in 1 year it snowed every month except August. And even on the 4th of July they had some inches of wet snow that year. The snow go was throwing a lot of snow out of the way. They had a couple of them and they were running all the time during the winter. This picture from the other end of the upstream end of the town site, looking back during snow period.
You must have been doing some more tree climbing,
right? Hi?
You must have been doing some more tree climbing here.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there were still the trees here. I don't think I could show you the one now. That's, you realize that's 50 years ago? My goodness. And of course, the snow got much deeper, and this was a very common scene. When the snow came, it snowed. This was what we called a soon-to-be incomplete ski jump. I have our VCR on Winter at Holden, which we showed at the fireside room yesterday, and it showed this. The same man, George Bator, showed him in slow motion as the ending of what happened here. Rick, are you planning to show that Winter at Holden tomorrow? Huh?
Yes.
Yeah, he is. Where, in the fireside room?
Yes.
Okay. 10 o'clock, okay. Now this was nothing compared to what it got to be, that is, for the tunnels. They've told me that the snowfall was about 200, 220 inches accumulated during the years when I was here. Later they had 400 inches. I looked over at the rec hall for the graph that was showing the inches per year.
622.
But you have it up the museum? Rick, do you have that graph?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Other people can tell you stories about the heavy snowfall year and the washouts that they had and the problems.
Larry, how were those buildings heated then?
Buildings were heated, main buildings were heated with oil, that is, the bunkhouses. Down underneath each bunkhouse there was a boiler, the hot water transfer to the rooms, hot water radiators. And I don't know whether they were using oil or wood over at the executive row over there. That is, there is a...
Most of them are wood-fired furnaces.
They're wood-fired now, but were they then?
Yes.
They were oil, I think.
Both. But my house was always wood-fired, and then it was converted to oil.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And while we're on the subject here, we went for a walk up there at the 1500 level and looked down on an immense field of cordwood all cut. Is that going to be burned this year? Will be. Wow, what a transport job. One of the last pictures, my hobby was mountain climbing. That's one of the joys of being at Holden. You didn't have to go very far. You just put your pack on and stepped out of the assay office. and you were on a mountain. And this is the way up Bonanza Peak. The Holden Lake is down below the view of the picture, and then the climb is up the terminus of the glacier and then up across the... The glacier had receded quite a bit from times past, but there wasn't any record of it. And you get it wind around and get up the Snow Thumb, which is that very last bit of snow, and from then going up to the ridge and along the ridge. And this is the last slide. Thank you.
Great, Larry.
Glad you enjoyed it.